Hello, and thanks for listening to the Black Country Talking News. This week's edition is for the 4th of August, 2021.
Hello, and welcome to the Black Country Talking News, brought to you by Sightloss charity, Beacon Centre. A message to our listeners who receive the Talking News on CD in the post. This remains in paper envelopes, so there's still no need to send anything back to us. We're pleased to confirm that the Talking News is now available via Alexa. All you need to do is say, "Alexa, play Black Country Talking News." Our Talking News service is also available via the following methods. Calling 01902 213 210. Visiting our website, beaconvision.org/talking-news, as a podcast on the Black Country Radio website, blackcountryradio.co.uk/podcasts, on Spotify and Apple Podcasts by simply searching Beacon Black Country Talking News and hitting the subscribe button, and on your mobile or tablet device by downloading the free British Wireless for the Blind Talking News application from your App Store. We hope you enjoy this week's edition.
Thank you, Simon. And reading this week, we have myself, Rob, writer Graham Fisher, Mina, Ed, Craig, Helen, Simon, Angela, Christine, and of course, Flashback Roger. In this week's edition, we have an update from Beacon, some local news from the Black Country. We have the quiz with Mina, news from Wolves and West Bromwich Albion, a Did You Know section from Flashback Roger, a feature on yoga, the weather, Craig's Black Country joke book, information about Beacon's digital inclusion project. Rounding all that off, we get to hear from Graham Fisher's In My Opinion. But first we have our Guess the Sound quiz. I'm going to play a sound clip, and all you have to do is simply guess what it is. So, here's this week's clip. Have a think on that, and Mean will reveal the answer later alongside the usual quiz answers. Now we start, as always, with some local news, brought to us by myself, Rob, Ed, Angela, and first up, it's Christine.
Nearly 15,000 people in the Black Country and Staffordshire were contacted by the NHS COVID-19 app and told to isolate last week, figures reveal. The app warns people that they have been in close contact with someone who has tested positive for coronavirus. People contacted through the app are advised to isolate for up to 10 days, although there is no legal obligation to do so. Across England and Wales, nearly 700,000 alerts were sent to COVID app users in the latest 7-day period, a record high and 11% more than the previous week. NHS figures show 3,021 people in Dudley were pinged by the COVID app in the week to July 21st, the latest available data. It was an increase from the 2,373 alerts sent the week before. The figures also show that 2,053 people in Wolverhampton were contacted to isolate, an increase from the 1,526 the previous week. Community Secretary Robert Jenrick has urged people to isolate if they are advised to do so, saying there isn't very long to go until August 16th, when all fully vaccinated contacts in England who test negative can avoid isolation. He said, "I appreciate that it is a significant number of people and it can be frustrating, but the app is doing what we asked of it." While isolation is not mandatory for people pinged by the COVID app in England, anyone who is contacted and told to self-isolate by the NHS Test and Trace service has a legal obligation to do so.
More than 58,000 people remained on furlough in the region at the end of June, despite almost 13,000 people coming off the Job Support Lifeline. The figures were revealed as a think tank warned that reliance on furlough is still a cause for concern, and said it is vital people return to work soon. Charlie McCurdy, economist at the Resolution Foundation, said, "With employer contributions to furloughed staff doubling, and the scheme ending completely in just 2 months' time, it's vital that as many furloughed staff as possible return to work soon, in order to limit the rise in unemployment this autumn." Government data showed that 58,300 people were on the scheme across the Black Country in Staffordshire as of June 30th, down 71,200 at the end of May, a decrease of 12,900. Neil Anderson, Director of External Affairs at the Black Country Chamber of Commerce, said, "As the scheme fades away, we will likely see individuals being released into the labour market as businesses struggle to recover or are forced to make redundancies. It is crucial employers and the government provide them with the support they need to retrain in order to become re-engaged in workplaces." HM Revenue and Customs figures show that 6,900 people in Wolverhampton were furloughed, 1,200 fewer than the 8,100 at the end of May. It represented 6% of all that were eligible for the scheme. And in Dudley, 8,500 people were furloughed, 6% of those eligible, down 1,700 from 10,200.
A Black Country School Academy Trust, which lavished hundreds of thousands of pounds on consultancy fees and payments on a non-existent car, has been found to have misused public money. A government investigation into the Learning Link Multi-Academy Trust, which runs four primary schools in Dudley, revealed it spent more than £400,000 of taxpayers' money without following the correct procedures. Learning Link, which is responsible for Sledmere, Cates Hill, Dudley Wood and Netherbrook primary schools, also doubled the pay of its then chief executive, Paul Harrison, without following due process. The investigation carried out by the Education and Skills Funding Agency accused Mr. Harrison of a lack of integrity and said the Learning Link trustees have failed in their duty to hold the leadership to account. It found that tens of thousands of pounds were spent with companies in which Mr. Harrison had a direct personal interest. The report also revealed that the trust had given Mr. Harrison £38,500 to cover a car, leasing costs and private medical cover without proper approval by the trust board. The investigation also identified a further £292,989 that was spent without any evidence of a formal tendering programme. There was also in some cases a conflict of interest, it added. These transactions breached the trust's financial regulations and are deemed contentious and improper, said the report. The trust, which was set up in 2017, was told it would be stripped of its responsibilities last year following a warning by the school's commissioner for the West Midlands, Andrew Warren. It now has a new board of trustees and leadership team and is in the process of transferring the school to the new trust.
More than 3 million COVID vaccine doses have been administered across the Black Country, Staffordshire and Birmingham, official figures show. NHS data shows a total of 3,013,123 jabs, first and second doses, have been administered in the region from December the 8th last year to July the 28th. It comes as vaccine clinics continue to run across the area almost every day, as health chiefs call on people to do their bit and get their vaccine. In Dudley, 404,896 doses have been administered, with 220,801 first doses and 184,095 second doses. While in Wolverhampton, a total of 300,726 vaccine doses have been administered by chiefs, made up of 166,132 first doses and 134,594 second doses. Councillor Jasbir Jaspal, Wolverhampton's Cabinet Member for Public Health and Wellbeing, said, "The rollout of the vaccine is continuing apace, and it's brilliant news that over 300,000 doses of the life-saving COVID-19 jab have now been given in Wolverhampton. There have been over 30 walk-in vaccination clinics running each week at locations all around the city, enabling residents to get their first or second vaccinations at a time or place that is convenient to them without needing to book ahead. Together with pre-bookable appointments at vaccination sites and pharmacies, these clinics are making it easy for everyone to get protected." England's Deputy Chief Medical Officer said that the vaccine rollout has prevented over 22 million cases of COVID-19 and 60,000 deaths in the country. "And with the number of infections in our city still high, I would urge anyone aged 18 and over who hasn't yet had their first or second doses to do so as soon as possible."
Health chiefs in the Black Country are being probed by the NHS about their behaviour, according to reports. Professor Steve Field and David Loughton, who run Wolverhampton and Walsall NHS Trusts, are the subject of the NHS England Review. Professor Field is chairman of both trusts, while Mr. Loughton is chief executive of the Royal Wolverhampton NHS Trust and interim chief executive of Walsall Healthcare Trust. The Health Service Journal, a news organisation which covers the NHS, says the allegations came from whistleblowers in Walsall. A spokeswoman for Walsall Healthcare Trust said, "Our organisation is fully cooperating with the review. We believe it is important that everyone involved has the opportunity to speak freely and feels supported to raise any concerns they may have." A spokesman for NHS England's regional team in the Midlands added, "It is vital that all NHS staff feel comfortable raising concerns about the organisations they work for. An independent review into these claims is currently underway." Mr. Loughton became the interim chief executive of Walsall Healthcare Trust in April. It followed the trust being rated inadequate for its medical care by the health watchdog called the Care Quality Commission. In taking up the position, Mr. Loughton has a shared role in both trusts. He is the longest serving chief executive in the NHS and has held his role at the Royal Wolverhampton NHS Trust for more than 17 years.
Now it's time to hand over to Helen, who has for us this week's Beacon Update.
Hi everyone, it's Helen from the Beacon Centre. Well, welcome to August. Let's hope it's a month filled with health, happiness and some pleasant weather, eh? First up this week, we're excited to let you know about a new virtual session we're launching that's all about Braille. Thanks to technology changing the way that Braille is used, it's as relevant as ever. So, if you'd like to improve your skills, why not join our new weekly virtual class where our trainer Kerry will be teaching the basics. It'll be held every Tuesday, and like all our online sessions, it's free to join. Contact Kim Williams on 01902 880 111 or via kwilliams@beaconvision.org to find out more. Next this week, we wanted to say thank you to everyone who's donated to our Heart of Beacon campaign. It helps us support our members, one of whom told us, "Beacon's very important to me. It gives me something to look forward to each week." Over the past 16 months, more than £100,000 has been raised so that we can help people with sight loss. And now we're hoping people will support us again so that we can continue to help people feeling lonely and less confident as a result of the pandemic. If you donate to our Heart of Beacon campaign before the end of August, you'll not only help us meet the £1.2 million costs of running our Sedgley Centre each year, you'll also forever be part of the Beacon family with your name on a heart-shaped mural in our centre reception. You can donate online via www.beaconvision.org/heart-of-beacon. That's www.beaconvision.org/heart-of-beacon. Or donate £10 by texting heart-of-beacon to 70085. Text messages cost £10 plus one standard rate message. If you donate via text, please email your full name to supportus@beaconvision.org so we can include your name on our mural. Don't forget, whether it's in our shops or at our centres, we're taking measures to ensure Beacon remains COVID-19 secure while cases remain high locally. Here's a message from our Chair of Trustees, Kathy Roper. "The pandemic has been incredibly tough for everyone, but it's been especially worrying for the vulnerable. And we'd encourage everyone to think of others, as keeping your distance and wearing a mask could help someone vulnerable to stay safe." Now, it's time for our sight loss tip of the week. Chop, chop, chop. If you want to make the most of your sight in the kitchen, here's our top tips for keeping a vegetable stable while cutting it up. All you need to do is put a metal comb with a handle into a vegetable before making cuts between the teeth of a comb. I'd say just don't use it to brush your hair afterwards. If you need help with sight loss, call 01902 880 111 and ask for one of our sight loss advisors. That's it for this week. Hopefully, I'll be back to catch up with you all again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for that update, Helen. Now we enter another block of local news. And first up, we have Angela.
Urology services in Wolverhampton and Walsall are set to be merged in a bid to cut huge waiting lists. Members of City of Wolverhampton Council's Health Scrutiny Board heard how the teams at New Cross and Manor Hospitals will come together to form a team of 14 consultants and 10 specialist nurses. Under the proposal, emergency cases and some elective inpatient care from both areas will be carried out at Wolverhampton's New Cross, but daycare cases for lesser conditions will move to Walsall Manor instead of being treated in Wolverhampton or Cannock, as has been the case for years. NHS bosses in Wolverhampton said it is believed this will help free up capacity at New Cross and cut the numbers of people waiting for services. Data presented to the board showed 481 people in the city with minor conditions have waited more than a year for urology services. Other statistics showed the time people wait for surgery in Wolverhampton is 18 weeks compared with Dudley, which stands at 11 weeks. Mike Sharon from Royal Wolverhampton NHS Trust said the trusts face different challenges. Walsall has a small department and has challenges making its staffing work to provide safe 24-hour care. Wolverhampton has a larger department, but we struggle with demand and waiting lists. By coming together, we definitely see opportunities to make better use of the consultants and general clinical workforce that we have and to achieve better and quicker services for patients.
Work on a Wensbury to Briley Hill metro extension are progressing further as installation of another major structure along the route gets underway. The installation of a railway bridge on Coney Gray Road, Tipton, follows the successful removal of the previous ageing structure in autumn last year. Works to replace the bridge started on the 2nd of August, with a construction team building new supporting structures before concrete beams are lifted in to form at the new bridge later in the year. In order to allow activity to take place, a localised road closure is required on Coney Gree Road and Victoria Road until early 2022. Councillor Jackie Taylor, Sandwell Council's Cabinet Member for Sustainable Transport, said it is fantastic to see that works for the Wensbury to Briley Hill Metro extension are continuing to progress. The reinstallation of the Coney Gray Road Bridge brings this much-needed route closer to fruition. This is exciting for both residents and businesses, as the route will make it easier for those in Tipton and the surrounding areas to travel around the region using a more sustainable mode of transport. It is important to note that there are some localised travel disruption during these works, and we encourage people in the area to plan their journeys or consider walking or cycling as an alternative where possible. Ian Collins, Project Director for the Midland Metro Alliance, said, "The bridge is being replaced so that it can meet the needs of the modern light rail network. This is yet another major step forward in the project and is another clear sign that construction for this highly anticipated route is moving ahead of pace, even during the pandemic. It is excellent that residents can now see significant activity taking place in their local area. We will continue to work closely with Sandwell Council in order to minimise disruption where possible."
Opposition councillors have called for increased scrutiny of the work highly paid senior staff do after a planned restructure was agreed at Wolverhampton Council. The authority is to create two new high-level posts with salaries between £127,296 and £134,957 under the first phase of its Our Future Senior Leadership scheme, which says it will bring savings in the long term. At a recent full council meeting, where it was agreed to proceed with the restructure, the ruling Labour group said that the total number of management posts would be reduced and the new roles would not cost taxpayers any extra cash. But Conservative group boss Wendy Thompson slammed the report as just half the story and raised fears the promised savings would eventually come as a result of lower paid workers losing their jobs. She also demanded more councillors across the chamber hold the senior executive board to account for the work they do. The two new posts will be a new Executive Director of Families, leading a merged Children's and Adults Directorate, and a Chief Operating Officer. Two vacant posts of Head of HR and Head of Democratic and Support Services have been deleted and fall under the responsibility of the Deputy Director of People and Change, which carries a salary of between £87,317 and £96,449. Bosses also agreed to remove the Director of Housing post, which is on the pay scale of between £99,580 to £119,954. Councillor Brookfield said the overall changes would help the authority get away from the silo mentality the authority has been working in.
The West Midlands Mayor has joined forces with two other regional mayors to call on the government to extend the pilot scheme for tackling homelessness. Andy Street made the plea with Greater Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham and Liverpool City Region Mayor Steve Rotherham over the Housing First pilots. The three schemes have worked with 1,245 people in total, with 812 people having been housed in secure tenancies and 87 more supported in another home. Mr Street said, "We all know homelessness is the ultimate exclusion, and rough sleeping is at the sharpest end of that. Thankfully, we've made real progress in tackling rough sleeping across the West Midlands in recent years, thanks to some brilliant collaborative work, but there's still so much more to be done. One of the keys to our success so far has been Housing First, which gives some of the most challenged people in society safety and security, and the belief that change is possible. By combining a home with skilled intensive support for as long as is needed, the programme has made a real difference to hundreds of people's lives in the West Midlands. Speaking to people with lived experience, it is clear they have put their trust in our programme. I am therefore extremely keen that the Housing First model continues with government support, and we honour that trust placed in us by society's most vulnerable." The mayors want the government to extend funding for the pilots and for the comprehensive spending review to include cross-departmental sustainable funding to ensure people on the programmes are supported and don't risk returning to rough sleeping. They were speaking at a stakeholder event last week with more than 200 delegates from across the pilot areas and were being joined by Housing and Rough Sleeping Minister Eddie Hughes MP. There were an estimated 1,018 people across the pilot programmes who will need support when the funding ends. A meeting of the cross-party all-party parliamentary group on Housing First last week also backed calls for an extension of the pilots.
Bosses at hard-hit attractions across the region are hoping for a bumper August as they battle back from the effects of the pandemic. After a difficult 18 months, zoos, theme parks and museums are now seeing visitors' numbers creeping towards pre-COVID levels. Despite many having to limit numbers and ask people to pre-book tickets, venues like Dudley Zoo are seeing an upturn in business. Derek Grove, director of the Zoo and Castle, said there was definitely an appetite for people wanting to visit outdoor attractions, and they hoped August would see 2,000 people a day coming through the doors. While bosses at the Black Country Living Museum said they were encouraged by the level of pre-bookings over the summer holidays. Grant Bird, head of communications at the Tipton Road site, said, "We've been encouraged by the level of pre-bookings we have received for this year's summer holidays. Bookings are up versus 2020, but at this early stage of the summer break, we have yet to see the peak levels of 2019. Other tourist attractions across the region are also reaping the benefits of a boost in summer trade, including the West Midlands Safari Park, Wild Zoological Park and the Severn Valley Railway. Rachel Alcock, publicity manager for the West Midlands Safari Park, said, "We reopened our gates on April the 12th and some indoor areas remained closed until a few weeks later. Now the park is fully open, but we have obviously been running with a smaller capacity than normal as everyone has to book in advance. We're keeping entry levels down to a third less than at normal times. However, we have been fully booked every weekend from April and we massively appreciate the public support."
Now we have the quiz questions from Mina, which this week have an Olympic theme.
Hello and welcome to the Flashback Quiz. All the answers you need can be found later in Flashback Rogers' Did You Know feature. But for now, here are your questions. Are you ready? Question 1. Where in the world is the Olympic torch officially lit? Question 2. What is the fastest Olympic torch has ever been carried in the air? Question 3. What do the 5 Olympic rings represent? Question 4. In what year were medals cut in half because of a tie? Question 5. In what year were women first allowed to compete at the Olympics? And finally, question 6. What name was given to the London Olympics in 2012? As always, I'll be back to reveal the answers later in the show, but for now, good luck!
Thanks for those quiz questions, Mina. Now we have another block of local news, read by myself, Rob, Christine, Angela, and first up, it's Ed.
Leisure centre staff have been praised for their quick-thinking actions, which saved a man's life at a badminton court. Brandon Healy and Steve Cox came to the aid of 73-year-old Martin Jones, who collapsed from cardiac arrest while watching others play at Crystal Leisure Centre in Stourbridge. A fellow badminton player began giving Martin CPR and was swiftly joined by Brandon and Steve on the 28th of June. They were able to step in and use one of the centre's defibrillators to give Martin life-saving treatment until paramedics arrived. Duty manager Helen Bowen helped set up the defibrillator and managed the scene. Martin regained consciousness at the centre and, after receiving medical care, is now recovering well. He said, "I've been playing badminton at the Leisure Centre for many years, and up until that morning I had been well. I remember suddenly feeling dizzy, and the next thing I knew I was surrounded by paramedics, having regained consciousness in the centre. I can't thank the people who helped me enough. They gave me life-saving treatment until the paramedics arrived, and I will be eternally grateful. Thanks to the swift response of them and others, I'm now on the mend, and all being well, I hope to be back at the Leisure Centre playing badminton sometime soon once my treatment is finished."
A council is to overhaul its vehicle fleet and expand its use of sustainable energy as part of a multi-million pound investment to achieve carbon neutral status over the next 7 years. Wolverhampton Council's dated and pollution pumping vehicles will be dumped in favour of electric, environmentally friendly alternatives. Bosses will also ramp up the switch to sustainable electricity and heating, which has seen it cut back on energy use over the last 2 years. The changes form part of the Council's bid to become carbon neutral by 2028 as part of a national push to cut local authority emissions. Cabinet members have signed off on the plan, which will involve significant investment initially by the City Council. However, as well as helping the climate, bosses said the council would reap the benefits financially further down the line. Wolverhampton Council became the first Black Country authority to declare a climate emergency in 2019, which led to it drawing up a green strategy. Since then, the authority has slashed its carbon footprint by more than 50%, preventing 7,000 tonnes of greenhouse gases being pumped into the atmosphere by switching to renewable electricity and replacing streetlights. Major changes will include bringing in electric vehicles and creating electric vehicle pools for staff rather than using their own cars for work, which some do now. Low-carbon heating systems will be installed in buildings, while the council will look to sell off buildings which are underused or empty. A tree planting programme is also planned, while bosses are looking at introducing car solar ports, where cars are parked under a solar panel-covered structure to harness energy for charging and other uses.
A colourful monument paying tribute to key workers and remembering those lost to COVID will be installed at Dudley's Russell Hall Hospital. Planning officers at Dudley Council have given the thumbs up to the Russell Hall Rainbow proposal, which will see the creation of the 6 metres long and 3 metre high piece. As well as the main rainbow structure, which will be made up of glass hearts, there will be 2 clouds on the outside and a plaque featuring a quote from Captain Sir Tom Moore. The aim is to pay a lasting tribute to all those Dudley Borough people who worked hard during the pandemic, as well as remembering those who died as a result of the virus. A fundraising appeal for the monument was set up by the Dudley Group NHS charity last year and raised more than £16,000 for the project. They said, "We all owe more than words can say to those right on the front line in the fight against this virus. We think this monument would be a fantastic way to publicly recognise the work of all key workers across Dudley and would be a lasting reminder to all. It will be placed on land between a pavement and the car park, near to a pedestrian access into the hospital, close to the roundabout junction of High Street, Kingsbinford Road and Pensnet Road."
Bookmaking group Forterra has reported a return to pre-tax profit during the first half of its financial year. The company, which includes the Cradley Heath Special Brick Factory on Congreve's trading estate in Cradley Heath, has posted a pre-tax profit of £27.1 million, up from a loss of £2.3 million in the same period of 2020. Meanwhile, revenue increased to £118.3 million from £122.4 million over the same period. Forterra said, "There was a strong recovery in the first half trading, underpinned by robust demand from both new build and repair, maintenance and improvement markets. Looking ahead, it said the current favourable market outlook and trading conditions are expected to continue, and its order book remains strong." CEO Stephen Harrison said, "We saw a strong recovery over 2020 in the first half, which exceeded our expectations. This performance, primarily in bricks and blocks, was underpinned by robust demand in both the new build and the repair, maintenance, improvement markets. Overall, group revenue increased 47% over 2020 and, notably, revenue in bricks and blocks slightly ahead of 2019 levels. The current strong trading conditions appear set to continue in the second half of the year, with our customer base signalling they expect current levels of demand to continue."
A £5 million screen school is launching at the University of Wolverhampton. "It is an important investment," explains Vice-Chancellor Professor Jeff Layer. "During the lockdowns that started over 15 months ago, we have all changed our behaviour. Not just in who and how we see people, how we travel and what we can do, but also in a massive increase of time spent in front of screens of one type or another. We have all had to adapt to different ways of living, learning, caring and working. However, we have all become more highly digitally skilled and empowered, and that will fundamentally change our society and economy for the future. It may well have been changing anyway, and the pandemic may have just hurried up that shift. So how will this change be seen? We already know that the amount of time spent on gaming activities or consoles and smartphones will equip individuals with particular skills around hand-eye coordination, dexterity problem-solving, and creative solutions. Place that in a health setting and how they use robotic surgery with the consultant operating a console or keyhole surgery with similar techniques, but in a very different setting. Now we need to use those skills around animation and gaming to change many of our business practices. This will lead to the region starting to become a bigger centre for the creative industries, not just the growth of leisure activities, but also in terms of shaping business practice. This need for those creating, drawing, designing, shaping skills are in great demand, and we need to provide greater opportunities for young people to develop those skills."
Coming up next, we have some information read by Simon and Christine. First we hear about Beacon's digital inclusion programme, then we find out some details about an opportunity to get an Alexa device, upon which you can listen to the Black Country Talking News.
Hello, I'm Simon, one of the IT trainers here at the Beacon Centre. During these digital and online times, do you find yourself struggling with technology? Could you benefit from IT support or training? Well, if you live in the Dudley or Wolverhampton boroughs, then the Beacon Centre may be able to help. Our digital inclusion project provides IT support and training to anyone living in the Dudley or Wolverhampton area with a visual impairment or any other disability. We can provide IT support and training either remotely or face-to-face where deemed safe. We can help with various issues from laptops to mobile phones and tablets and so much more. We can train you on using the internet or help with any other IT issues you may need support with. We may also be able to loan you equipment in some circumstances. circumstances. If you would like more information, then contact the Beacon Centre on 01902 880111. We look forward to hearing from you.
For our Talking News listeners in Wolverhampton, Beacon have 15 Alexas to allocate, and they're free of charge. They will be allocated on a first-come, first-served basis, and members will need to fit the following criteria. Live in Wolverhampton, have broadband in their home, have access to a smart device to download the app, smartphone or tablet. This can be done on a family member's device if they don't have one personally. To have a disability or have sight loss. The Alexa will belong to Beacon and are available to loan. If you would like to be one of the first to listen to the Talking News on an Alexa and would like one on loan from Beacon and match the criteria, then contact Beacon for more information on 01902 880 111.
Up now, we have our final block of local news. And speaking to us first, well, it's me. A huge free festival is set to bring the party to Wolverhampton city centre. Enjoy Wolverhampton Live will take place in Queen Square in the centre of the city on Saturday, August 7th, and will offer a festival with entertainment for all ages. The event will feature family fun and entertainment from 1pm to 4pm, then the live music concert from 6pm to 10pm, featuring M People singer Heather Small as the headline act. Other entertainment on the day will come from Dicky Dodd, CBB star Sid Sloan, S Club 7 star Joe O'Meara, X Factor star Red, and British house and dance DJ Graham Park. The day-long event is being organised and funded by Wolverhampton's Business Improvement District. The Business Improvement District Director, Cherry Shine, said, "We're extremely excited to be bringing live music and family entertainment back to the heart of the city for our biggest event, Enjoy Wolverhampton Live. Queen Square offers a fabulous space to host a vibrant mix of singers, DJs and TV personalities to perform in a great outdoor setting. COVID-safe measures will be in place and people attending are asked to take a lateral flow test 24 hours before the event. For more information, go to enjoywolverhampton.com.
Visitors will be able to sleep near white rhinos and giraffes under plans unveiled for the West Midlands Safari Park. The Bewdley attraction has submitted proposal plans to Wye Forest District Council for the second phase of its Safari Lodges accommodation. 8 new lodges will sit in a two-storey building next to the recently opened Elephant and Cheetah Lodges and offer panoramic views of the site's wildlife. Alongside the introduction of the lodges, the plans also focus on upgrading the Safari Park's animal facilities, including a new giraffe house and a rhino and antelope house, both of which will offer animals 24-hour access to their indoor and outdoor environments. Angela Potter, head of wildlife at West Midlands Safari Park, said, "Safari lodges have provided us with an amazing opportunity to improve our animal facilities, something which is vital to the welfare of our animals. We have large groups of giraffe and white rhino here at the park, and the impact the new indoor houses and updated external habitats are going to provide for them will be wonderful. It's an exciting next step and we look forward to continuing to look after these beautiful species and work to support their conservation in the wild." West Midlands Safari Park's giraffe and white rhino are both part of the European breeding programmes, which support the conservation of their species and raising awareness of their endangered numbers. If planning permission is granted, work is due to commence in September, with ambitions for completion in spring 2022.
A family fun day has helped to formally reopen a church's community centre after a full refurbishment. St Joseph's Church in Wolverhampton held the fun day and fair outside the church in Moseley Village to celebrate the reopening of the parish club after a £30,000 refurbishment. The day saw a selection of stalls outside selling cakes and refreshments, a bouncy castle for children, a DJ playing throughout the day, and a variety of activities, including a Zumba class. Father Craig Fullard said the day had been a tremendous success. "Things went well today and we were very blessed by the weather, as we were worried it was going to rain. We also raised around £2,215, which will go towards some of the work we've had done on the parish club, including a new ramp for disabilities and easy-to-access doors. There was a real mix of people who came to the event, from elderly people to families and single people, who all came together to have fun, including two OAPs who got on the bouncy castle. Father Fullard said he wanted the newly refurbished parish club to be a community hub, and he said he was looking to organise more activities at the centre. He said, "We're going to ensure we have regular events at the club, which will be open every Friday, Saturday and Sunday as a public club. We're looking to start the over 50s group again on a Wednesday afternoon, starting this week, and we'll have Zumba restarting and the toddlers group starting up in September. We're just trying to get back to a sense of normality whilst also recognising that COVID is still around and we've got to do things safely."
Visitors to an attraction near Bridge North will be arriving in style on a vintage double-decker bus. Dudmaston Hall, a National Trust property, will be operating the service in partnership with the Severn Valley Railway. The vintage bus service will run on Tuesdays during August from Bridge North Station to Shropshire Hall. The 1950s double-decker will transport passengers who have booked as part of their steam railway journey and walk-on passengers if there are seats available. I hope that passengers enjoy their time with us at Dudmaston and choose to explore our lovely local town, its shops and cafes, after the return journey to the station. Tickets cost £5 per person. Entry to Dudmaston Hall is free for National Trust members and under fives. There is a 5% discount on admission prices for non-members who arrive on the vintage bus service. For Severn Valley Railway timetables and tickets, visit the website svr.co.uk, and for the hall visit nationaltrust.org.uk/Dudmaston.
Alton Towers Resort has announced new events for Christmas, including an interactive light experience and a traditional Christmas market. From November the 27th to December the 23rd, the resort will be transformed with lights, festive entertainment and seasonal treats. For the first time ever, the Staffordshire-based resort is planning to open for day guests. New for 2021, the resort will sparkle as it partners with Lightopia to host the UK's biggest light and lantern festival. The theme will be Sense of Seasons and will take guests through the four seasons with lanterns, light installations, a water show and colour transformations. Tower Street will be transformed into a festive wonderland with more than 60 Christmas market stalls for guests to explore, from unique crafts, festive food, mulled drinks and more. It will also see the return of Santa's Sleepover, which includes an overnight stay in one of the resort's themed hotels, a visit to Santa's Grotto, one-day entry to the theme park, plus the Christmas market and garden lights walk. Chris Carter, Events and Entertainments Director at Alton Towers Resort, said, "Last year, Christmas was cancelled for so many people, which is why this year we are dropping the C word early, as we want to make Christmas bigger and better than ever. For the first year ever, we are opening the resort to welcome day guests for our exciting Lightopia and Towers Christmas Market, with selected rides and attractions. Christmas is all about bringing people together, which will be more poignant than ever, and something we want to really tap into here at the resort. We remain committed to creating a much-needed form of escapism for families and thrill-seekers across the UK and beyond. We've got an incredible lineup of seasonal entertainment and festive delights, which we're sure our guests will love."
It's time once again to hear from Flashback Roger, who has for us some more amazing facts.
Well, hello everyone. We've had the football, then the tennis, and now we've got the Olympics in Tokyo. Although this year is 2021, they're calling it Tokyo 2020. They say it's for marketing and branding reasons, but my guess is that if they rename it 2021, they'll never sell last year's stuff. Anyway, enough of my opinions. So here goes with this week's Olympic selection. Now, did you know that the Olympic torch is lit the old-fashioned way in an ancient ceremony at the Temple of Hera in Greece? Actresses wearing costumes of Greek priestesses used a parabolic mirror and sun's rays to kindle the torch. From there, the torch starts its relay to the host city. It's usually carried by runners, but it has travelled on a boat, on a plane, and on Concorde, and on horseback, on the back of a camel, by a radio signal, underwater, and in a canoe. The relay torch and the Olympic flame are supposed to burn during the whole event. In case the flame goes out, it can only be reignited with a backup flame, which has to be lit in Greece as well, and never with a regular lighter. The five rings of the Olympic symbol, designed by Baron Pierre de Coubertin, co-founder of the modern Olympic Games, represent the five inhabited continents of the world. The six colours, blue, yellow, black, green, red, and the white background, were chosen because every nation's flag contains at least one of them. During the 1936 Berlin Games, two Japanese pole vaulters tied for second place. Instead of competing again, they cut the silver and bronze medals in half and fused the two different halves together so that each of them had half the silver and half the bronze medal. And Olympic medals are not made of gold anymore, but are only finished in gold. They're mostly made of silver in this day and age. The last time they were made entirely of gold was in the 1904 Olympic Games. Women weren't allowed to compete in the Olympics until 1900, when the IOC became committed to equality, although it took over 100 years to fruition, when in London, in 2012, the Olympic Games became known as the Women's Games. Why? Because it was the first Summer Olympics that showcased true equality. Women were not barred from a single sport, and for the first time in history, each nation sent a female competitor. Well, there you go then. Some little known things about the ancient games. Personally, I'm full of admiration for these athletes. I think they're amazing. As the last time I ran for a bus, I missed it. So I'll gently stroll over to the cafe and get me a nice breakfast bap. I'll be back next week, so until then I'll say bye for now. Ta-ra a bit. Ta-ra.
Thank you for those fantastic facts, Roger. Up next, we now have Mina, who has for us a weather update.
The weather for this week starts off wet, but will gradually become dry and settled. Temperatures will be steady, rising as the week progresses, starting at 19 and peaking at 24. UV levels are expected to be moderate throughout the week. The sunrise and sunset times are 5:42 a.m. for the sunrise and 8:45 p.m. for the sunset. For Friday 6th of August through to Sunday 8th of August, we have light rain showers and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 19 degrees. On Monday 9th through to Wednesday 11th of August, we have sunny intervals and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 23 degrees. And finally, on Thursday 12th of August, we have light cloud and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 24 degrees. So that's your forecast for the week. As always, enjoy the weather.
Up next, we have our Sounds of Nature feature, which this week is an uninterrupted recording of a coastal atmosphere made at Bee Sands in Devon.
Thank you.
This recording was made by Lawrence Shove and was made available by the British Library. Now we have the latest football news from Wolves and West Bromwich Albion. Albion scored four times in the second half as they rounded off pre-season with an impressive win at Blues. Albion were missing Matt Phillips, with the winger self-isolating, while there was once again no Matthias Pereira in the visiting squad, but the playmaker is likely to leave before the end of the transfer window. Blues made the brighter start and good defending was required from Kyle Bartley to clear Ivan Sanchez's dangerous cross after Clark had been robbed on the left wing. Gradually Albion began to find some rhythm. Robinson came close to finding Dean Garner with a dinked ball over the top, before Grant headed narrowly off target from Darnell Forlong's cross. At the other end, Clark was alert to head Jermaine Bella's teasing cross over the bar, with Lukas Djukovic waiting to pounce. As half-time approached, Grant drew the first serious save from either goalkeeper when he cut in from the left and fired on goal, Wolves' Loney Sarkic tipping the shot around the post. Blues had an early escape in the second half when Sarkic was unable to hold Furlong's corner, and Robinson unable to turn the loose ball home as his shot was blocked. 5 minutes after the break, Albion were ahead. Furlong crossed left-footed from the right and Dean Garner nipped in front of Sarkic to guide his header over the keeper and inside the far post. Sarkic then prevented Grant from quickly doubling the lead when he saved a low shot with his legs following a rapid Albion corner. But the keeper's day took another turn for the worse on 69 minutes when he was at fault for Albion's second. Sarkic came for it but got nowhere near as Alex Moat's in-swinging free kick and after a scramble where Robinson was close to stabbing home, Clark eventually nodded in from close range. The Baggers were well in the ascendancy and soon led by three. Robinson went through on goal after he tumbled under the challenge of Roberts. Referee Stephen Martin pointed to the spot. Grant stepped up to send Sarkic the wrong way and prompted more celebrations amongst the 1,887 travelling supporters. Blues substitute George Friend squandered a great chance to score when he headed off target. Moments later, the ball was in the net at the other end, Tulloch putting the final touch on a fine move when he converted Zahor's pullback. Meanwhile, off the pitch, Valerian Ismail has confirmed that Matthias Pereira will play no part in Albion's championship opener at Bournemouth, admitting the forward is not committed to the club. Pereira sat out all of the Baggies' pre-season fixtures in order to avoid an injury, which might scupper his chances of a move to the Premier League. That arrangement is now set to be extended to competitive fixtures, with Albion due to start their campaign at the Vitality Stadium on Friday. Ismail said, "I've spoken to Matthias for a few weeks. He was clear he wants to leave. He's not committed to the Championship and not committed to us. I accept this decision, but I have to take my decision, and now we need to solve the situation. Albion are prepared to sell both Pereira and goalkeeper Sam Johnston in order to boost their transfer budget, but no deal appears close for the Brazilian playmaker." Ismail continues, "At the minute, we're talking, but there is nothing clear. I'm just focused on my guys who are ready to play for West Brom and ready to embrace the fight in the Championship." Wolves returned from their Marbella trip with a journey to Stoke, drawing 1-1 as their pre-season preparations continued. After flying back to England last Thursday, there was no rest for the players as they trained on Friday and arrived at the Bet365 Stadium on Saturday. A strong Wolves side started brightly, with Adama Traore the main threat, but fell behind due to a poor set-piece defending as former captain Danny Bath finished in the bottom corner. Within minutes, Wolves were level, however, when Raul Jimenez anticipated a loose ball in the box and finished from close range. The second half saw Wolves dominate and control the ball, with substitute Morgan Gibbs-White shining as a part of the front three, but they could not find a way through and settled for a draw. Despite playing another fixture within just 24 hours, away to Coventry, Bruno Lage named a strong Wolves starting 11 against Stoke as he started in a 3-4-3 formation. Connor Cody and Traore came in for their first pre-season appearances, while Fernando Marcel was preferred over Ryan Aitnori at left wing-back. Lage also named a strong bench, which was topped up with several youngsters. And overall, despite the draw, he could be proud of his pack, with many in the squad showing off improved fitness levels. The following day, Wolves picked up a 2-1 pre-season away win at Coventry, but were dealt two injury blows in the process. Bruno Lage made 8 changes to the side that started against Stoke as he stuck with the 3-4-3 formation. Mosquera, Neves and Adama Traore were the only players to keep their place after all starting and coming off at half-time in Stoke. The rest of the team was largely made up of first-team stars that did not start the previous game, with Christian Marquez the only youngster starting the game. Some more academy players were named amongst the substitutes. The hosts, buoyed by a good home atmosphere on their first game back in their stadium since 2019, started the game well and attacked the inexperienced Wolves back three. Several set pieces came and went for the Sky Blues, all of which were dealt with, before Wolves took the lead in the 7th minute. A corner from Traore at the back post, and after his shot was blocked, the ball fell to Neves. He delivered a lovely sweeping cross across the goal and found Silva all alone to tap in from inside the box. Moments later, Wolves' defensive flouters reared their head as Waghorn latched onto a through ball and should have scored, but lifted his effort wide. Mosquera was then forced off from injury after seemingly tweaking a muscle. He was replaced by Bueno, who went in on left wing-back, meaning Reit Aynori moved to the right and Kijana Hoover moved to the back three. Traore's bulldozing run then set up Morgan Gibbs-White, who, one-on-one with Soren Moore, shot high and wide. Wolves' injury issues then got worse when substitute Bueno was forced off and replaced by Kem Campbell, meaning Aynori again moved back to the left. Despite the injury concerns and defensive struggles, Wolves entered the break winning 1-0. The first chance of the second half fell to Campbell, who did well cutting in on the right flank, with his eventual shot being held by Moore. After 10 minutes, Wolves found the second through Neves. He was found on the edge of the box by Gibbs-White, and his sweeping effort from 20 yards took a deflection before finding the back of the net. Within minutes, however, Coventry found a way back into the game. Hoover bundled over Waghorn in the box, and the striker stepped up to get his team back into the game from the penalty spot, sending John Ruddy the wrong way. The hosts, with the crowd behind them, were then on top and should have equalised through substitute Tyler Walker, who scuffed an effort behind at the back post, despite being unmarked. The game began to fizzle out as the half progressed, with Wolves looking after the ball well and both teams making several substitutions. In the end, Wolves won 2-1, despite some defensive struggles throughout. Sticking on a sports theme, up next we have Mina, who has for us a piece all about yoga.
For increased well-being, researchers suggest there is no better activity than yoga. But first, what is yoga? Yoga is an ancient form of exercise that focuses on strength, flexibility, and breathing to boost physical and mental well-being. The main components of yoga are posture and a series of movements that are designed to increase strength, flexibility, and breathing. The practice originated in India about 5,000 years ago and has been adapted in other countries in a variety of ways. Yoga is now commonplace in leisure centres, health clubs, schools, hospitals, and even surgeries. The ability of yoga is to help dial back both physical and mental problems, but there's more. Even at this early stage of research, a regular yoga practice appears to be linked with increased well-being, including better sleep, better body awareness, weight loss, and greater happiness. By improving mindfulness, it simultaneously helps to boost compassion, gratitude, and a flow states, all of which contribute to greater happiness. Early evidence suggests that yoga may even slow aging on the circular level, perhaps through its stress-busting efforts. What makes these findings so exciting is that they suggest a regular yoga practice can improve multiple areas of your life at once, creating positive feedback loops that can further promote health. For example, yoga can help improve your sleep, which in turn gives you more energy and focus during your day. When you feel better physically and mentally, you have the energy to adapt to better habits, including a healthier diet and more physical activity. These changes in turn can lead to better weight control, which helps with a host of physical problems. More exercise, not to mention fewer aches and pains, can improve your sleep. Yoga facilitates sleep by reducing stress, anxiety, and arousal, all known causes of poor sleep. One small study looked at meditation and breathing practice. 20 people who had trouble sleeping did the 30-minute practice every night before going to bed. After 8 weeks, researchers found that participants were sleeping 36 minutes longer on average and waking up less during the night. Overall, the quality of their sleep improved by 11%. Most forms of yoga are not strenuous. However, yoga does wonders for mental health, and it also counts as strengthening exercise, with at least 2 sessions a week will help your mental health. Activities such as yoga and Tai Chi are also well recommended for older adults at risk of falls in order to help improve both balance and coordination.
Thanks for that piece on yoga, Mina. I best start limbering up. Up next, we have Craig's Backcountry Joke Book.
Hello, I'm Craig, and I'm going to tell you some jokes from my Backcountry Joke Book. Vincent van Gogh is in a bar, and his mate walks in. He spots him and shouts over, "Do you want a beer?" Van Gogh replies, "No, tar, I've got one here." Here's another one for you. I went to a fancy dress party in Gornal where the theme was spice. I went as a chili, but everybody else was dressed as an astronaut. And finally, I went to the supermarket in Ceres and I said to the manager, "I want to make a complaint. My vinegar's got lumps in it." And he said to me, "That ain't lumps, they're pickled onions." I'm Craig, and that was my Backcountry Joke Book. Thank you.
Thank you for those jokes, Craig. And coming up next, we have Mina with the answers to this week's quiz.
Hello, and here are your answers for this week's flashback quiz. Are you ready? Question 1. Where in the world is the Olympic torch officially lit? And the answer, in the Temple of Hera in Greece. Question 2. What is the fastest the Olympic torch has ever been carried in the air? And the answer here is, when it was Concorde. Question 3. What do the 5 Olympic rings represent? And the answer here is, the 5 inhabited continents. Question 4. In what year were medals cut in half because of a tie? And the answer here is 1936. Question 5. In what year were women first allowed to compete at the Olympics? And the answer here is 1900. And finally, question 6. What name was given to the London Olympics in 2012? And the answer here is the Women's Games. How did you do? A gold medal performance, definitely. If not, there's always another chance to have a go next week. Now, did you get the answer to this week's Guess the Sound question that Rob asked at the start of the show? Here's one more chance to hear it before I let you know the answer. The sound you just heard was a recording of someone striking a match. Now, to end this week's edition of the Backcountry Talking News, we now head over to Graham Fisher for another edition of In My Opinion.
Hello. Many of an age not unadjacent to mine may fondly recall those futuristic puppet series of 1950s and 60s vintage, where our childhood daydreams of space travel, underwater exploration, and technical wizardry were given life through our string-powered wooden heroes. I was fascinated by the likes of Thunderbirds, in which Jeff Tracy directed operations from Tracy Island and communicated with his intrepid sons manning Thunderbirds 1 to 5 from the deepest ocean to outer space by way of Videolink. Videolink. Speech and vision over vast distances. Fantastic. Unbelievable. Such is the march of progress, eh? By the time I'd reached middle age, Videolink technology, once the illusory provocateur of a children's television series, now came as bog standard on my home computer. And yet I barely used it. Not blasé or indifferent, I was keen to, but more of a common notion that despite all this newfangled stuff, you can't beat meeting face to face. There's nothing like a pandemic to fracture complacency. And the COVID-19 scourge, with all that has entailed for social distancing and group gatherings, has not too subtly caused us to completely reevaluate that one. Sales of video conferencing packages have hit stratospheric levels, and it's now the norm across the board, from virtual meetings of family and friends through to corporate undertakings, presentations, lectures, concerts and broadcasting, home teaching, the whole gamut. And I suspect that, having been nudged across the cyberspace of Rubicon, we will not be reverting any time soon. Me? I welcome it, if only for very practical reasons of time and sheer cost. Until shortly before BC, that's before coronavirus, I was routinely undertaking a 7-hour round trip by car, together with the accompanying fuel bills, in appalling traffic congestion, and all to offer a meeting little more face-to-face than it's in my report. Lunacy, of which no more. Video it is. Which brings me to some of the ticks, foibles and protocols that have already sprung up around the video conference phenomenon, where, by its nature, one is looking at a fellow contributor, or plural, set against a backdrop of their personal environment. And how many of those settings, I have noticed, are shelves of books? Artificially contrived for the occasion? Who knows? It's not just me who suspects. The various radio shows are frequent around the dial now routinely make a point of commenting to the listener how their fellows, whom we of course cannot see, are surrounded by books. Whether or not they are, it's all knockabout stuff with sardonic undertones of scholarly pretentiousness. Yet here, notwithstanding the welcome levity, is where I profoundly disagree with the implication that to own and show books is an ostentation, an attempt at trying to look clever. I believe a good book to be the counterpart of a good friend. You may not have been acquainted very long, you may not know them very well, you may not wish to be at their side all of the while, but when you are together, your life is enriched. You wouldn't abuse your friend, you don't deface a book. You don't conceal your friends through awkwardness, you openly display your books without prejudice. And, perhaps most significantly, you may never get to learn all there is to know about your friend, in the same way that it is no shame to admit there are books you have never finished reading. But you're nonetheless moved by them, to the extent that you embrace them as part of your comfort zone. I'll now lay a small wager that one of the sharper examples of the latter in recent years will be Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time. First published in 1988, it has sold over 25 million copies to date and looks impressive on any bookshelf. Yet, I question how many of its purchasers have read it for any distance beyond the first few pages. Why this is a germane exemplar lies in my confession that not only have I not read it, I haven't even bought it, but I will. It is, to extend my analogy, a future friend I just haven't met yet. I don't know how well I'll come to know it, but presumably, much like the 25 million who have gone before me, I would value its acquaintance. One particular book that did come my way recently, as a gift from my other half, caused me to make the comparison with Hawking. Weighing in at just shy of 400 pages, it was destined to keep me occupied for a while, so after a couple of deep breaths, I decided to put all the other partial reads to one side and give it a go. I'm glad I did, and the opportunity afforded by enforced time alone enabled me to devour it voraciously. There may not be too many good things to come out of lockdown, but this was up there. How the World Thinks by Julian Baggini is one of those rare tomes that goes way beyond the norm in fundamentally refocusing one's perspectives. But I do hope that doesn't sound hyperbole. Perhaps it may be less flamboyant to instead say it has channeled, crowbarred my thoughts into new realms of understanding. I've alluded to Bikini elsewhere in my deliberations, and on the strength of this, I will likely do so again. Dr. Julian Bikini is Academic Director of the Royal Institute of Philosophy, the author of several of the books, and a regular correspondent for national magazines, periodicals, and think tanks. Notwithstanding his evident intellect, the appeal of How the World Thinks is its sheer accessibility, aided considerably by an elegant syntax that hits the minimalist bullseye with a combination of unerring accuracy and graceful efficiency. Take this, for example, in his digest of Part 1. I hope, he says, that it is now obvious why I have started this book by asking how the world knows. It might at first look an abstract question, but if we want to understand how the world thinks, it is fundamental. It helps one to be better prepared to understand ideas about how the world is. Gosh, I wish I'd written that. One section that especially caught my eye, which doesn't really narrow it down because they all did, is Bikini's exposition on time. Hawking examined time too, but Hawking was a scientist, Bikini is a philosopher. Entire volumes have been given to explaining the distinction, so forgive my condescending clumsiness in thinking I can do so in one sentence, but here goes. Philosophy is the quest for knowledge by logical thought in questioning the nature of the universe. Science is the establishing of facts by data-driven observation. Hawking's conclusions? Take another look at his book. There's 25 million out there somewhere that will give the lowdown on his empiricism. And Bikini? Well, he explores the quite mind-expanding distinction between linear and circular time. The what? In Christian society, we're accustomed to thinking of time in a straight line, specifically yesterday, today, and tomorrow. This is reinforced by a religious doctrine of life itself along a course from birth through the now and to our eventual death. Now, we've considered this as a default for our faith in progress lying in the forward direction since the age of the Enlightenment. Conversely, some cultures, notably those who rely on oral tales and folklore as evidence of identity, believe their history goes full circle and must be passed on through the generations for its sense of place to survive. In direct contradiction to the Book of Revelation that describes Jesus as Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last, Alpha and Omega are at one and the same point. The beginning is the end. The first is the last. The circle may not retain the same dimension, but may expand as time progresses through successive generations. In some Middle East paradigms, there is a hybrid of the linear and cyclical. Islamic conceptions of time are as cycles based on appearances of prophets, but which develop linearly by moving humanity forward towards the ultimate revelation signified by the Judgment Day events associated with the appearance of the Mahdi. In Chinese cyclical thought, wisdom and truth are timeless, and we do not need so much to go forward as to hold on to that we already have. Confucius believed that his purpose was not to announce any new truths or initiate any new economy, but was to prevent that which is already known from being lost. While such divergences from our concept of linear time may be difficult to grasp, they are a prerequisite to us understanding the likes of Maori ethos and Aboriginal dreamtime. Most of us would be hard-pushed to identify our own metaphysical framework, that is, our personal understanding of the structure of nature. But we all have one, and without realizing it, unconsciously base our assumptions and values on tenets that have been instilled in us generationally. And, as Bikini suggests, it is bringing these assumptions to the surface that we may also better understand how other peoples, not of our persuasion, see the world and why they see it that way. It is, as he concludes with commendable clarity, sometimes, simply by changing the frame, the whole picture can look very different. Now, let us cut to the chase. Does that not sound like an elucidation of the root cause of centuries of war and conflict across the globe? And does it not also offer a pragmatic contemporary roadmap towards a resolution in just about every one being played out right now? It certainly did for the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was founded on a conciliatory recognition of widely divergent standpoints following the collapse of apartheid. There's a thoughtful scene in an otherwise grim psychological murder movie, Seven, released in 1995, and starring Brad Pitt alongside Morgan Freeman, where Freeman is researching late at night in a library. He notices a group of night security personnel idling and queries why, surrounded by a world of knowledge at their fingertips, they choose to play cards. A quarter of a century later, when they might instead be video chatting with their mates, let's hazard a guess at where they'll position the laptop camera. Apropos my earlier rebuttal of the implication that to own and show books is an ostentation, an attempt at trying to look clever, I'm willing to concede exceptions. The demise of the printed word has been predicted almost from the day that William Caxton's press ground into life in the late 15th century. Yet, despite our monumental technical advancements since then, books are still around in some abundance. Notably, it now seems, on video links. Long may it continue, if only for me envisaging certain conceptual difficulties in making friends with a hard drive.
So that's it for another edition of the Black Country Talking News. A reminder to our CD listeners who have received CDs in padded envelopes that you don't need to send anything back to us. If you have a sight loss tip or someone you would like to wish a happy birthday to, just say hello to. Maybe even a poem or talking book you would like reviewed, then please get in touch with us at the Beacon Centre. Call 01902 880111. Email bctn@beaconvision.org or write to us at the Black Country Talking News, Beacon, Wolverhampton Road East, Wolverhampton, WV4 6AZ. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for listening, and thank you to all our supporters, donators and volunteers who without their support we would be unable to run this free service. Please note the information and views expressed in this recording does not necessarily represent the views of Beacon or Talking News and were accurate at the time of recording. Mentions of goods and services does not imply endorsement, and whilst every care is taken to supply accurate information, Beacon and Talking News do not undertake liability for any errors. So it's goodbye from all of us. Stay safe, have a good week, and we look forward to bringing you next week's edition of the Black Country Talking News. Ta-ra!